Hey, welcome back to another edition of Old School Guns. This is episode number 35. So here we are on a very, very somber day, September 11th. And anyone over the age of 25 probably remembers this day exceptionally vividly. This was a day, of course, that the terrorists struck the Twin Towers and the Pentagon, and also the flight that crashed in Pennsylvania. Flight 93, escape me there for a minute. As you well know, the country for about 6 months was totally united and supported going into Afghanistan after the Taliban, and here we are 18 years later, and it's amazing to think that a soldier who enlisted just before those attacks is probably getting ready to retire right now from the military. We've been there that long. Far too long, in my opinion. Far too long. But we do have to, we did have to punish the bad guys and punish the enemy as much as we could. But it's really not about the war on terror. The September 11th anniversary was, for most Americans, it was our Pearl Harbor. I grew up hearing stories of Pearl Harbor, how shocked everyone was, how it absolutely shattered the nation's consciousness and kind of shook our faith and our place in the world order. We thought that Japan was a minor regional power and that they would never dare attack the United States. That's what most Americans in 1941 thought. They'll never dare attack us. And of course they did. The other earth-shattering moment came 22 years later with the assassination of John F. Kennedy. I was so small at the time, I really didn't understand the full implications of it. But I do remember one of my earliest memories about gun control was our teacher came into our kindergarten class and made the announcement. We were all sent scurrying home, and the deal was she would never let us play cops and robbers or cowboys and Indians or anything, because she said guns killed President Kennedy. And even at that age, I remember saying, well, guns don't really kill anybody. It's people who kill people, and they can use guns, they can use other things. But everything I'd seen on television showed me that if bad guys had guns, well, so did the good guys, and the good guys eventually won. So it wasn't about guns. Guns weren't really any more important than cars. I mean, the bad guys had cars, the good guys had cars. Or horses, if it was a Western. I mean, it really didn't make sense to me at the time. I remember being very confused by that. So, of course, when I asked my parents, they told me that it was bull. And since then, I've never listened to another gun control purveyor who says guns kill people, because they don't. People kill people. And that's the thing to know. But September 11th, I really thought the country came together after the September 11th attack. I thought it brought out the best in a lot of people. But, that's all frittered away, and look where we are now. I observed September 11th, and I am saddened by the fact of where the country is now. These triggered liberals, people that the politically correct speech, the way our society has really decayed just in the last 18 years is amazing. Who would have thought on September 12th or 13th, 2001, that we would have two radicalized Muslim people in the House of Representatives, that somehow they would, the identity politic faction of the Democratic Party would gerrymander districts in order to get two people like this who are very radical, anti-Semitic, anti-American, and just representing and associated with radical groups, probably involved in jihadism, although that remains probably to be proven. But these people are how they got into our Congress, I don't know. They don't deserve to be there. They need to be removed, and they need to be voted out. And hopefully 2020, those two in particular, will be given their pink slips and sent out of Washington. And I hope a lot of the other Democrats who are absolutely rooting for America to fail, which is what they're doing, I hope they go with them. I hope there's a groundswell and essentially sanity is restored to our government. And we have leaders. I don't really care that everybody is in agreement. I'm not saying a one-party state. I'm saying that we literally have leaders that can talk on a rational level and see truth for what it is. We have a problem with truth in this country. We can't seem to tell it. You look at the Russia investigation, that hoax, that smear charlatan hoax that was perpetrated by complete dirtbags in our government, and our news media bought into it incredibly. They bought into it as far as you can. It reminds me of I saw some polling data where it showed every single Democrat, even the ones polling 2 or 3%, beat Donald Trump head-to-head in a general election. The only way that kind of polling is possible, and I used to do polling and data analysis and all these other things, the only way that is possible is if the polling agency polled predominantly Democrats and predominantly people who are not going to vote for Donald Trump, and they get that sample wherever they get that sample. It's a lie, it's a fiction, and it's propaganda. These people are worse than Pravda. They're worse than Pravda of the Soviet Union. They're putting out, they're Joseph Goebbels. George Stephanopoulos is nothing more than a cracked up version of Joseph Goebbels. They're even about the same height, I think. They look kind of alike, too. But be that as it may, that's what that is. That's what you see. And it's literally like watching news speak from 1984. It's an altered reality they're trying to push on everybody. Remember, these were the same people who predicted, it was about a week before the election, maybe 10 days before the 2016 election. They were showing that Hillary Clinton had a comfortable 10-point lead. And we all know that was completely frickin' bogus. There were a few, you know, kind of fringe polls out there that showed what the that were closer to the truth, that showed them about dead even. However, we know that that wasn't even the case. We know that wasn't even the case. So, you know, think twice before you believe in fake polls, fake pollsters, and the talking heads on the media. I mean, it's an absolute outrage, what has been pulled, what has been done. And I don't think a lot of low information voters have picked up on this, that essentially what's coming through their boob tube is not really the case and is not really what America is or how the majority of people feel. And it's a shame. It's criminal. It's absolutely criminal. But moving on to that, we talked to something else that's, in my opinion, criminal, and I love telling this. I'm in the market for some new tires, and it's, you know, they are going to kind of be on a, you know, a smaller SUV, but an SUV nonetheless, so therefore they're more expensive than tires for a sedan. And I was considering, I'd actually looked at a bunch of Walmart's offerings online. And I'd pretty much decided on the tires I want. But then Walmart decides they're not going to sell pistol ammo or certain types of rifle ammo. And basically, I'm now boycotting Walmart. I wouldn't buy a stick of gum in Walmart. Walmart is dead to me. I've never really liked them for a variety of reasons. As I said in the last podcast, they're a storefront for the Chinese government and their cheap products. And there's a lot of things I've purchased at Walmart which, you know, because I'm only going to use it once or twice, I can get away with the cheapest crud they sell. But, you know, it's not the highest quality, and, you know, I've just made up my mind. I'm going to buy better quality, and if I have to pay a little bit more and maybe do without a couple of things, that's fine. Walmart is dead to me. Walmart is garbage. And Walmart, this may not be very much money to them. You know, what I spend in Walmart probably won't hurt them. But I hope that there are a lot more people like me, and I think there are thousands of us, and Walmart's going down the tubes. So guess what, Walmart? You just sold somebody else a set of tires. Not your tires, but their tires. Hasta luego, Walmart. Okay, and something a little more lighthearted. It appears that InRange TV is licking their wounds over their the best battle rifle test that they ran, or whatever that thing was. Yeah, they've only put up one or two videos afterwards, and I think one was historical, and the other's more like a forgotten weapons one, where they go, Japan did not turn out a lot of submachine guns in World War II, thankfully, and they're kind of doing a walk around of one of the rare Japanese submachine guns. That's the only two things I've seen them put up. They may have put up something else too, but they appear to be licking their wounds over that, and they should. They should. They've gone from, you know, interesting kind of content of discovery learning of, hey, I'm going to use this in a match, and these are the things I discovered, and, you know, to the point where they pompously think that they are now small arms, military small arms experts without a DD-214 on either case. How that happens, I don't know. But they think that they're experts, and this test showed how amateurish they really are. So they've now become kind of a McDonald's of gun content on YouTube, and I hope that they're reevaluating that. I would like to see them take a month off and come up with something better than feel they have to put up a video every 3 days. I know that there's hunger out there for videos, but there's also hunger for quality. So stop being McDonald's. Start being something a whole lot better, and I think they will find that their support actually increases. And, you know, that would be a good thing for them. Their Patreon support would probably notch up several ticks if the quality improves. But, yeah, they've provided a lot of fodder for me over the last couple months. Not as much as that the Guerrilla Gunfighter book. I basically pummeled that pretty hard, justifiably so, in my opinion. But there's a lot of gobbledygoo out there, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. But a bright story is, you know, gun magazines are kind of on the wane. I should say on the wane. They are, you know, they're just on the way out. They used to be the sole repository of knowledge in the pre-internet days, but now they're not very timely. The gun magazines were responsible for a lot of the repeat myths that we have about guns, and some of the things like the 45 automatic is 90% effective and one shot stops, you know, 90% of the time you get a one shot stop. I don't think there's any data that actually supports that. But somebody pieced together some anecdotal shootings and came up with that. And then it just gets repeated until it gains some sort of credibility, until it is actually debunked or proven otherwise. There's a whole lot of things like that. And the AR-15 M16 is a huge, huge part of that. I mean, for years, the rifle was considered trash, because people read it over and over and over again in gun magazines. But the best gun magazine going out there, and the only one I really read anymore, is Handloader, because it contains very practical, useful information. And it's stuff that, you can look it up on the internet, but, it's got a lot of, it goes a lot farther in depth than a lot of things you find on the net. So it's an excellent magazine. And if you handload, I would say it's absolutely essential. It's essential you get a subscription to that. So, Handloader magazine, it's still got a few of the older style. They're not necessarily old men, but they're older style gun writers that I really enjoy. And guys who kind of harken back to an earlier era. The one that I like the best is Brian Pierce, who kind of comes across in many ways in the same mold of a Skeeter Skelton or a Bill Jordan, a little bit of Elmer Keith, maybe. You know, just a very enjoyable a gun writer to read. Of course, it's got Venturino and a few other guys in there that are you know, kind of hand loading standards and really put out information that is pretty solid. So that's a great magazine, and they really deserve the support. Most of the rest of them can go by the boards, but I like Handloader. The other thing I really like about Handloader is it's one of the few magazines where the advertising is worth it, because you can find special tools and other things in there that you really can't find anywhere else. You wouldn't even know they exist unless you saw them in Handloader. You know, yeah, they have a web presence, but you wouldn't even know to look for it if you hadn't seen them advertised in Handloader and say, wow, that looks pretty good. I'll look that up on the net and see if there's any further info. So it's an excellent, excellent magazine, well worth getting and keeping. And it's really not that expensive. Comes out like every 2 months, so about 6 issues a year. Okay, the next one is, I got this in response to the book review. And I've kind of touched on this before, but, you know, the question asked of me was, well, why don't you like prepping? And this is really not a question and answer type of a question that I do in the latter part of the podcast. I will tell you that I am not a fan of prepping for a variety of reasons. When I talk about prepping, I'm talking about the hardcore doomsday. I do believe what FEMA tells you is true. FEMA tells you, keep water in your house, keep a couple days supply of food, have a way to cook it, maybe have an alternative energy source so you can boil water if the power goes out. You know, I have ways to carry water, you know, and I have those things. You know, I have some emergency rations, and I could last maybe even a week. I've got some cans. I've got some big water cans I can put water into. I've got a way to basically boil water if I need to. I got all that kind of stuff. You know, I got all that kind of stuff. The guys who really, I think, go overboard are the ones that live a lifestyle which it always seems to start out one way and progress into a fantasy world that eventually they lose control of. And I think that's where that book came in. That book is about how to deal with the fantasy world that people think is going to be out there. I said it yesterday or the other day in the podcast. You're never probably ever going to be in a complete dystopian world where, you know, the rule of law is completely suspended, or at least be in an area or in a situation where you're not accountable for your actions. And, you know, too many of these guys think, hey, it's going to be, hey, the power's out and it's going to be free for all, man. It's going to be free fire zone. You can open up on anybody. And that's not the case. That's really not the case. And the other thing I think people get off into is, well, I got to have a precision rifle because I could be shooting at 500 yards. And it's like, well, I don't know about that. If there's a really good chance you're going to be held accountable for your actions, you're not going to shoot people at 500 yards. It just doesn't seem to make sense. So it's a very, very tricky situation. I don't want to argue, because somebody will say, well, there could be a situation where, okay, there could be, but you know the chances of that are extremely small. And if you did get into that kind of a dystopian world, I don't know how long an individual or even a small family group or even a small retreat group, whatever type of group convention, unless you have a really massive group, I don't know that you're going to last that long, because it always seems like you will never have the element of surprise. You will never have the numbers. They will always attack the weak points. You'll never have the numbers, you know, really to match the one-on-one or whatever. It seems like you'll always be outnumbered, and they will attack at the time and place of their choosing. It just seems like it's just not very practical. So I have problems with it there. the journey I've seen some people go on is they start with individual skills, kind of that naked and afraid or dual survival kind of skills. Hey, you're stuck out in the woods and I know how to do this, that, and the other thing, and repurpose all these natural materials or scrounged materials to basically give me the wherewithal to survive. Then that extends to a group. Well, maybe it's my family needs to be able to do this. And to effectively do this, we have to live on our own little farmstead or homestead where we can grow rabbits and chickens and all these other things and eat them, grow our own vegetables and all that. Then it's when they realize that that is not a defendable construct from intruders, that intruders can just come in and overwhelm you and then take all your stuff, take all your goodies and all that. Then it becomes, well, we have to have something larger, and it's maybe a town, because a town is eminently more defendable. It has a lot more people in it. It has more resources. So we develop into a commune, and that's usually where these things kind of fall apart, because not everybody wants to live in a commune. Living in a commune is alien to Americans. We would only do it if we had to, and there are times and examples of where that's a good idea and where that's not. And some of these groups, frankly, they have mixed either radical politics or even more dangerously some sort of fringe religious beliefs. And when you start mixing firearms, isolation, fringe religion, you start mixing those three, it becomes a very, very unattractive, unappealing, and attention-getting deal. That's what it is. It's a deal, and that's what it becomes. And all of a sudden, you'll get all this unwanted scrutiny and attention. And most of the time, these things fall apart. Now, they did not fall apart in Waco. There's all these other places where they've kind of tried this and fallen apart. And that's kind of where this book, Guerrilla Gunfighter, came out of. People, the pastor in Arkansas who gave a glowing review of this book, I think he's just trying to help out somebody who thinks the way he does. And, you know, that's just influence, but it's dishonest. I mean, if the book is good, say the book's good. If the book is not very good and it's not very good, say the book is not very good and be done with it and move on. Survivalism has been this kind of, in the gun culture, has been a kind of a subculture of the gun culture. A lot of guys have used that over the years as an excuse to buy guns. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. You want a gun, buy it. And if you can justify to yourself, well, you know, this has got some other uses. But really all you'd need to do to buy a gun is to want it. But it started, there was a guy named Mel Tappan, who was an interesting character. I think he was actually very highly educated, had actually taught at Stanford, if my memory is serving me correctly. He'd been in like an economics professor at Stanford, had some medical issues, and at the same time decided to kind of drop out of society, retreat, and become a survival-oriented person. I don't know if he was a true prepper survivalist, but he wrote a lot about it, and I think for a lot of his later life he was confined to actually a wheelchair. So, you know, this wasn't, you know, Grizzly Adams out there doing this stuff. This was somebody who had some pretty significant physical challenges. But he wrote really well, and it was very entertaining, and he wrote a couple of books. I think I still have a copy of his book, Survival Guns. It was something every gun lover would appreciate. And it was a lot of fun. And again, these were pre-internet days. There wasn't a whole lot of content out there. And, you know, Mel Tappan talked a lot about guns that really weren't talked about very much, and some uses for guns that really weren't talked about very much. He had a regular column in Guns and Ammo magazine back when that was a pretty interesting magazine. And you know, and it was something that you kind of turned to. The only other part of Guns and Ammo I liked better was Cooper's Corner. You know, I was one of those guys, the minute I got the magazine, the first place I turned was back to Cooper's Corner, you know, to read that, because that was fun to read. Well, before that, it had been Survival Guns. That's where everybody kind of went the first time, you know, to kind of see how interesting that was. So, you know, that's where a lot of this started. And, of course, it's all been mythologized in the movies. You know, there's been everything from the Omega Man to every dystopian type of thing, TV shows, TV series, and it's good fun. Those are entertaining shows. They're good fun. We often kind of wonder, what would the world look like if there was no structure? And there's a lot of different takes on it, and a lot of different reasons. Some are invasions from space, some are plagues, and all these other things. Giant natural disasters, you know, kind of wipe out the social order, and it kind of is rebuilding or regenerating in some basically unknown way. So this stuff has all been out there mythologized. I don't, as a practical matter, don't spend your money on this. I mean, yeah, the few days, the week, or whatever else, what FEMA tells you is probably smart. But don't construct your life around this. And I know people who have, and it's I've known several people who've done this. And in one case, it destroyed a marriage because, you know, the husband was going to buy a $200 wheat grinder from Czechoslovakia, and his wife didn't share the vision that somehow he was going to get barrels of wheat and keep them, and then if food became a scarce commodity, she was going to be grinding wheat and doing whatever it is you do with grind wheat. I guess you make bread out of it. But yeah, she did not share the vision, and she didn't share the vision of all the other stuff too. And seeing money that needed to be put towards things in the real world kind of going into these preparations for a fantasy world that is not ever really going to be here. And I will say one thing, that some of these guys, and I know have known one or two of them, that, you know, they'll look you straight in the face with a straight expression on their face, and they'll say, "It's all coming down, man. It's all coming down. What you see around you is the fantasy." And I'm like, well, I don't think so. I don't actually think so. So now that we've taken the preppers to task, we can start my favorite part of the podcast, which is questions and answers. And the first one I got this in a conversation a few days ago. And it was an argument, actually, between two people I know. And it was about steel-cased ammo in rifles and pistols. And, you know, there is some American-made steel-cased ammo. It's what I saw was 9mm, called Windsteel. And I've actually used it. You know, it isn't bad. It shoots. What I like about steel-cased ammo, 9mm. We'll talk about pistols first. First of all, I've never found steel-cased .45 to be very good. It'll function. It will not function in carbines very well. I don't know why, but it just doesn't. It's okay, but I've never really thought that much of it. In 9mm, it kind of shines, because you usually wind up shooting so much of that that picking up brass is a pain. So you either let the brass lay, or you spend some time, you know, doing hands across the range and picking up, you know, and with the promise someday I'll reload this. But actually, the steel case stuff is so inexpensive, it's so economical, that you can kind of look at it and go, yeah, you know, I'll just shoot it. You let the steel cases lie, you know, just sweep up what you can to keep the range clean, and you know, you don't worry about it, because it's actually very, very economical. So I really like it in 9mm. I think it's pretty cool. Other calibers, pistol calibers, I really haven't tried. I'm trying to think if I've ever really, you know, I've gotten some surplus stuff in whatever the Talker Rev round is, 7.62x25. And, you know, that was fine. I mean, it's all kind of junky, old surplus ammo, but it seemed to work out fine. The guns did not have any problem with it. I think that, you know, when the Warsaw Pact was testing small arms, I think they use steel cases as they were an inevitability, and that's how it was. That was the standard. That was the baseline. So their firearms function with them very, very well. Every one I've tried, 5.45, 7.62 by 39, 7.62 by 54, and 9 by 18 Makarov, and the aforementioned Tokarev rounds. They've all worked. They all work in the guns they're designed to. If you're firing a Warsaw Pact pattern firearm, they work just fine. The places where they have had trouble has been in like the M1s, M1As, the 7.62 and 7.62 by 51, and the 30-06 have not worked out as well. They're probably okay in bolt actions, but they don't seem to have the pressure correct for the Garand system. You know, they didn't quite break the code on that. So those are problems. In 5.56, it used to be, oh, you know, people would look at you and it was this, oh, terrible look that you're using that. Now I think a lot of people use it. As a matter of fact, I see a lot of it on the ground. And it seems to function in direct impingement guns fine. Piston guns, I can't tell you, but direct impingement guns, it seems to work just fine. As you would kind of expect, because really the regulation in that is the size of the port and the tube. So it's, you know, and it's just a tube, and it comes back in and hits the bolt key and kind of goes. And if it's a little overpressured, that's gonna clean out those three pressure relief holes in the side of the bolt. But I've always found that the steel case stuff is a little bit actually under. It's less, 55 grains, it's less powerful than 193. So it's actually pleasant ammo to shoot. Some ranges have heartburn because it's steel, you know, steel cased. So they run a magnet because the only thing they can do is run a magnet. Anything attracts, they say, oh, can't use it, because they think the case is bimetal and it'll start fires or it'll damage their targets. When in fact, one of the good things InRange TV did was show that Ball 193 damages targets more than the 5.56 that had come from Russia or overseas that was steel cased. So I think it works fine. You know, your mileage may vary, but it seems to work fine in 5.56. It works fine in Warsaw Pact pattern firearms, but I would definitely be leery of an M1 or definitely an M1A. And I have heard that DSA, I saw a post that they put on Facebook saying they've done it, but they don't recommend it. They've also have found variances in pressure in some of the 7.62 by 51, which may be another reason why it's not really the best for an M1A, because you know, that requires a pretty consistent pressure that's within certain parameters and to make that whole gas system work. And clearly this ammo is not of that standard. So that's another reason not to use it. Okay, another question is, what is the deal with all these tactical accessories I see at the range? And the specific things are, you know, vests, tactical clothing, etc. You know, okay, I will say that, you know, I saw the rise of this stuff. Global War on Terror starts today, September 11th, the anniversary of the day it started, although you could argue it started before with some other things. We just didn't recognize it as such. But a lot of companies, there was a need for a lot of tactical equipment. The old Army LBE and LBV weren't going to make it. It just wasn't gonna work, and the old Army flak vest wasn't what was needed. So what we needed to do was come up with a whole bunch of new stuff. So we kind of had interceptor body armor, the stuff that we're kind of using today, and we had sappy plates, and we have all this good stuff. And you know, there needed to be some other kind of slightly lower end protective gear for people who were just running around in fobs or security details or something else. They may not need the full collar and all the Kevlar that the military body armor had, but they needed to carry the plates to protect their most vital organs. So a whole group of, there was a whole cottage industry grew up providing this stuff, and they went big time. They're selling it everywhere. You can still buy it. I mean, you can even still buy this stuff that's made for airsoft. You know, they're cranking it out in China. They're cranking it out everywhere. And frankly, every time you look at the news, you see somebody wearing a plate carrier. Whether it's actually got plates in it or not, I don't know. But you see that a lot of this tac gear has become the standard for every police, military, whatever else. So that's one of the reasons you see it out there. People see what the professionals use, and they go and get some version of that for themselves. Same thing with clothing. You know, the big explosion was with all the civilian contractors, armed contractors, and even contractors doing other things. There was need for rugged work clothing that could also double. Hey, it had an extra pocket so you could put magazines in it. It was a little bit lighter weight than what you would consider some of our construction stuff to be, because, hey, they were operating over in deserts. It was going to be light colored, so it didn't attract the sun. You know, you don't wear black shirt and black pants out there. You want to wear the lighter khaki colored stuff. So that all became a huge industry also. And that stuff is still out there today, you know, and they're making tons and tons of money off that. So you see that. The other revolution that came was, and we'll actually have the next question is about this, but more specifically, but holsters and all the other stuff that goes with the weapons, you know. And, you know, it's out there. Some of it's good, some of it's trash. Depends who you ask sometimes. Depends what your use is. Like I said in the last podcast, you know, you don't necessarily need, as an armed citizen, the same stuff that a Tier 1 guy is going to have, because his stuff is provided by an agency. And although a lot of those times those guys buy a lot of their own stuff, it's the core of what they use is usually issued to them. And so you're going to see that kind of stuff everywhere. It is very good stuff for the most part. You know, just do your research, any individual piece. You can kind of see what people on the net are saying about it. You can kind of figure out who's used it and when, and if they have moved on to something else for a particular reason or not. So that's why you see all that stuff. And you see quite a bit of it out at the range, at the ranges these days. You know, people, it's good range clothing. It's all durable, functional, outdoor, good stuff. So that's why you see it. Okay, here's the next one. Are Serpa holsters bad? And, you know, I wrestled around with this. I actually really like Serpa holsters. And I'm not talking about the cheap ones you get in Walmart or whatever else, the $29 ones. The Serpa holster was really designed for operators. And it was really at its best with the M9 pistol, with a heavy, you know, a relatively heavy DA pull. Smooth, nice DA pull, but a heavy first pull and then a transition to single action. It's very good for that, and it's very safe with that. A lot of the polymer-framed trigger safety guns, people object to that. They say, basically, hey, if I push the button on the Serpa to release the gun, as I'm withdrawing the gun, my finger kind of hooks and curls right in and inadvertently depresses the trigger safety. And if it depresses the trigger, I've got a negligent discharge while my gun is still coming out of the holster. So that was one argument. And in fact, there are a lot of trainers, quote unquote, who've banned Serpa holsters. And, you know, there's like a lot of things in the gun culture, there's a certain level of this Geardo drama around this, whatever, you know. I still have mine. I like it. I don't really use a holster like that much. So, you know, it is what it is. And that's just kind of, it's a good holster. The other objection to it was, hey, if you're rolling on the ground, some pebbles or sand or something could work its way into the mechanism and freeze it. That's legit also. And I've heard of that happening. It never happened to me, and it never happened to anybody I knew, but you know, if that's a concern of yours, then hey, there are other alternatives for your handgun. So that's where I am with Serpa holsters. It's a good design, but it's not a perfect design for every application. And I would stay away from the cheap ones. They make some for about $20, $30. It gets sold in Walmart or other cheap places. And stay away from those. That's a cash in, and that's just the way that is. Okay, next question is, and this is kind of related back to the book review, what 5.56 loads are the most effective? And the answer is it depends on your purpose. If you're a match shooter, you definitely want the 75. I found that the 69, 75, 77 grainers all shoot very, very well. Out to the distances I shoot, they shoot very, very well for match shooting. So I like all those. They're very accurate, and they're squared away for that. For general shooting, I like 55 grain. And it goes back to what I said in the book review that, hey, you're not going to be using your self-defense rifle at the distances that some people think. So if you're talking out to 100 yards, 55 grain is a great load to use. It's absolutely great. It's got higher velocity. It hits hard. It does what it's supposed to do wound channel wise. It's all of the original effects that the Stoner system was basically advertising and had in the early 1960s. So it was very effective then. It's very effective now. I don't care for the green tip. I said that in the podcast, and I said why. It's been dogged with some accuracy problems, and it's also been dogged that it doesn't really have the effect that the 55 grain projectiles do, at least at close range. So your mileage may vary, but that's what I think is the best. Is I would for close range defensive shooting and just general shooting, I like the 55s. And the good news is they are some of the most economical ones you can get. So not only are they excellent, but they're also economical. Okay, here's another question, and this one's actually fun. How has military rifle shooting changed over the last 30 or 40 years? That's interesting, and I really like that because that came out of a conversation of people of various ages from, say, their late 30s to their 60s. And, when I started rifle shooting, it was a whole different deal. Everything was completely different. If you went to a rifle range, you saw predominantly sporting rifles, and people would fire them and make sure that they're sighted in, might shoot them for a little bit of fun. But, there really wasn't a lot of shooting. If you fired 40 rounds at a single sit-in, that was a lot of shooting, and that probably took a lot of the day. That took several hours, Now, part of that was, of course, on square ranges, especially public ranges, they 15 minutes, they call a halt, everybody goes down range, checks their targets, comes back, and by the time you go that, so it takes, in an hour of real time, you might get half of that of shooting time. So, and that's part of the reason it took so long. But the other one was they didn't really make firearms that were shot a lot. Even 22s were, a lot of those were hunting pattern type firearms. And even the target rifles were really strictly indoor. And they were strictly, they were laborious to shoot. They were heavy. They were absolutely on precision and aiming. So it was exhausting to shoot those, both mentally and physically in some ways. What really started to change was people started hunting less, but they still enjoyed shooting. And then you started to see, let me go back a little bit. When I was shooting, the World War II and Korean War generation was still a big presence on the ranges. They were guys who were in their late 40s or early 50s, and they were there. And the kind of guns they liked to shoot were bolt action, very nice rifles, and all those sorts of things. They saw no use in the 5.56 and the early AR-15s. AR-15, Colt had been selling those since the early 60s, and really very few people bought them. Nobody really wanted them. Nobody bought them. And in those days, for just a few dollars, You could buy an O3A3, which was a very popular gun. You could buy a lot of things, and even you could even buy a few Garands. And as shooters started shooting more at ranges than hunting, then other types of guns started to become popular. And around this time, the Mini 14 hit the market. People really liked that. If you were a World War II or Korea guy, you liked the Mini 14 because you were used to handling guns that looked and operated like that. The M1A, the Springfield Armory M1A, and you know, there have been a couple in the 70s, there were a few different companies that were kind of producing those types of rifles. Those started to gain popularity, and actually, you know, the modern day Springfield Armory Company was built on that. People liked them. They knew how those guns worked. They liked them, and it's been a self-fulfilling prophecy ever since. More and more people get them, like them, shoot them. And so those guns were very popular. The AR was never popular. They'd been selling them since the early 60s, as I said, and nobody was really buying them. And because it looked different, it operated differently, it shot a different type of a cartridge on a whole different ballistic theory. And I can tell you, the first SP1, I took it out to the range, and people were actually swearing, going, "That rifle is blank, you know, those are the ones that jammed in Vietnam," and blah 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 blah. But I was shooting it, and I was actually enjoying it, and I said, "This is a lot more fun than some of these other things." It was certainly more fun than shooting my father's deer rifle or shooting a 30-30. I mean, it was a gun that you could shoot 40 or 50 rounds out of, and hey, you know, there you were, you know, you weren't all bruised up and worn out. So we've gone to the point where people really liked Garand style full service cartridge kind of guns, and we moved into the intermediate cartridges. Now the interesting part to me is that we have people who've grown up with intermediate cartridges. They've been around for 60 years. So anybody who's 40 or younger, this is the entrenched establishment gun, the same way that the bolt action full service cartridge rifles or Garands were the established guns back way back. So now as they see things like the M1A, they don't like it. It looks old and clunky to them. They think the FNFAL, the G3, are just these old clunky designs. You know, it's like a 57 Chevy, you know. Yeah, it might be kind of cool to play with, but it's not really a car I would want to drive every day or a piece of equipment I'd really want to stake my life on. So it's a very, very, you know, interesting situation. It's kind of come full circle that the outcast rifle of 30 or 40 years ago is now the establishment rifle that everything else is being judged against. So that's the big reason things have changed. Other changes have been really the revolution in precision rifles that's happened over the last 20 years has been just amazing. And also the rise of pistol caliber carbines, something that, you know, back in the 70s, 80s was not very well known. There were probably a few here and there, but really there's a lot more of them now, and people are valuing them a lot more and see the niche that they actually fill. So that's been another huge change in the last 30, 40 years. And of course you could talk about revolutions in optical sights and triggers and just the aftermarket stuff that's available, especially for the AR rifle, which is so modular, that it's almost spooky. It's almost spooky how advanced that design is. And we may be looking at it, and, you know, 40 or 50 years from now, I think people will be talking about how advanced that design was, and they may say it was 75 years ahead of its time, maybe even 100 years ahead of its time. Frankly, the only part of the battle rifle thing that InRange TV did was it showed how well that the 1957 design of Eugene Stoner went against the metrics that they had today. Of course, that rifle essentially originated the metric, so it's not surprising it did well, but it really holds its own today against some of these other rifles. And that's one thing that, that's one of the reasons I wanted to do the book review, was it just seems like we've gotten into this gear intensive mode where we have to hang stuff all over rifles. And, you know, maybe the most things we need on there is maybe a light, or maybe someone accompanying you with a light if you're, you know, if you're looking for critters that are going into the chicken coop or something else. There are a lot of these accessories and all that. How useful really are they? And, you know, I think there'll be kind of a renaissance where we kind of go back and say maybe lighter and thinner and less complicated is not only better, but it's much better. So here we go. Now that the 35th episode of Old School Guns is in the books, if you like what you heard, please hit any of those follower, like, subscription buttons. If you don't like what you hear, well, let everybody know, because I could use some comments and some on Podbean. So I'd be happy to answer to you or explain things further. So, you know, don't be shy. Your comments are very, very welcome. Anyway, this is Old School Guns, out.